This is a talk about a new open source monitoring system that I'm in the process of developing. And it's a work in progress, but it has some interesting characteristics, and that's what I want to talk about. Put this down for a little shorter person. And it really is concentrating on doing two things. One is exception monitoring of systems and services. And the second thing, I have to actually set this where I can see it. It has extreme scalability. It's basically order one. It's not 100% order one, but all of the stuff that takes up most of the time in monitoring is order one. What's not order one, well, we'll talk about that as we go on. Basically, 10,000 systems is not a problem. 100,000 is really not a problem. I have tested the setup of 300,000 simulated systems. It really doesn't have a problem with that. But the other interesting thing, which is probably more interesting for a lot of people, is it continually discovers what's going on in your environment. It discovers what services you have. It discovers what servers you have. And it continually updates a database on the information it finds there. And it does it in a way that doesn't upset your network people. That is to say, there's no port scanning going on here. There's no pinging of IP addresses to figure out who's there. It's basically does it on the basis of things that are already there that if you just listen, you can hear them. It's a bit following the saying of, it's amazing what you can learn just by listening. And that's kind of what's going on here, is it tries to observe what's there to observe, and on the basis of that, find an amazing amount of stuff. And I think you'll see how this works as we go on here. So it's for a variety of reasons, I set it up as a sub-project of Linux HA. It's a personal time open source project. It's currently licensed under the GPL and LGPL, small amount GPL. Around 20,000 lines of code right now, and as I said, a work in progress. This is how the scalability works, and I don't have a pointer with me, so I'll just walk over here. And I can't do this with the mic. Basically, all the machines are set up in monitoring rings here. Each system. Oh, okay, thank you. Excellent. I forgot and left mine at home. So each system then is monitored by a system above it and a system below it. So the base, and in this case, these are within a switch. So if a switch, let's say your switch has 48 ports, then you have a ring of 48 machines. And the nice thing about this is this means all of your traffic for the monitoring stays within a switch, almost all of it. I'll get to the other rings and you'll see the rest isn't all there. There's some other things that are there as well. There's also a green ring here so that if your switch dies, this system and this system would both report that the switch has died. And you can distinguish a server dying from a switch dying on the basis of the fact if this machine dies, you get four reports from this one, this one, this one, and this one. But if the switch has died, you only get reports from the green ring. So you can easily see what happens here. The interesting thing about this is this grows without bound, without increasing the complexity of who's talking to whom. So this will scale as far as your network goes. And no one has to talk to more than four servers under any circumstances. And it also has the nice property of being geographically sensitive. That is to say, if each of these different subnets is in a different site, then the only traffic that goes between sites is this one little ring here, which has, in this case, three different machines on it. And that's all. You could have thousands of systems on each site, and it would still only need to talk a very, very small amount of traffic across sites. So this is the basic idea of how it works. As I said, I set up three rings here. The first ring is within a switch. The second ring is those switches within a subnet. And the top level rings is the subnets. Now, you could, if you have more knowledge of your topology, you could change the ring structure to match your topology more exactly. The nice thing about this is it turns out that the code in each of these little blue boxes has no idea about topology. They just do as they're told. And for example, you could imagine if you really have a lot of subnets and a lot of sites, you could imagine a top-level ring above this, which is per site rather than per across the site, so you only have one representative from each site rather than potentially several. And this scales basically forever. It is the work on any one system never increases as the number of systems being monitored increases for discovering that something is wrong. However, there's a little bit of ring repair. If this guy dies, I have to repair the ring. I have to splice him out of the ring. That work is going to be order n, but order n with a very, very small coefficient. For example, for a million servers, you expect about 500 servers a day to die. That amounts to under 10,000 packets per day to do the ring repair. That is negligible by any standard. And a million servers is pretty far up. So I don't worry about it today. I'd love to have the problem that, gosh, that a million servers is, you know, I'm handling systems of a million servers and I have to worry about that. You know, but it's going to be in that range before you start having any kind of scalability difficulty here with respect to monitoring. So does that make sense? Simple enough? Anybody awake? Okay, one person's awake. Good. So this is how the scalability aspect works. Now, it's important to note that I have probes on every machine. But I take advantage of that in terms of the discovery in a minute here, as you'll see. So that's how we monitor servers. How we monitor services, and this is code that I haven't written to glue together. We plan on using a piece of software from the Linux HA project called the Local Resource Manager, or the LRM, which has been around for a long time. 2004, I think, is when it was first written. Which knows how to monitor lots of different kinds of services. It knows how to monitor using at least three or four different protocols. It will monitor using an init script status. It'll monitor using Open Cluster Framework, which is the preferred method. It'll monitor using Upstart. And it has plugins, so you could add others if you want. But the nice thing about it, it goes along with what I call a no news is good news philosophy. That is to say, when nothing's broken, it says nothing, right? Because we have a way of detecting that the server has gone down, that works. If you don't have a reliable way of telling the server's gone down, that's a very bad idea. But the way the pieces are connected to each other, if for example, it lost the connection to the LRM, it would know. Interestingly enough, it's also able to stop and start resources and can do things like, if one of your resources is a virtual machine, it's perfectly happy to migrate it. So it's a well-proven set of software that's been out there a while, and we have a reasonably active community creating resource agents for this. I think there are around 80 resource agents that have been created for it, something like that. Of course, the pros and cons here. Pro is obviously scalable to virtually any size. It's really simple to understand. You know, it's easy to see how it works, and it's easy to see that it scales the way I say it does. It has an incredibly fair, uniform distribution of workload. Every server monitors its own services, so that's why you don't have this problem of, you know, this machine is monitoring all the machines in the universe, so we have to get more machines and arrange proxies and load balancing and move things around. It just doesn't happen here. There's no single point of failure, easy to distinguish switch failure versus host failure, geographically sensitive, all these good things. Very lightweight on the network. Over 96% of the packets stay within a switch. Disadvantage is it requires active agents on all the machines. It is more complex than a ping script. Getting this up and having all the protocols and talking over the wire and having all these things happen, that requires code. Not especially complicated code, but quite a bit of it. There's a potential slowness at data center power on. If you're going to centrally manage these rings, which is the current plan, then when you start up, somebody's setting up all the rings when you first start. And I don't know how that's going to time out, honestly. In the case where I did 300,000 simulated servers, it took about 11 minutes to set those up. But that was all in memory with no database. So it could be two orders of magnitude slower with a database behind it. I really don't know the answer to that question yet. I've really just started the database code recently and have no timing data, nothing like timing data. So the other thing it does is what I call continuous stealth discovery. So I want to just define what I mean here, and it's sort of obvious. let's start with the word stealth, even though I wrote continuous stealth discovery. Stealth means that I don't send packets on the network to discover things. But you don't need to if you have agents on every machine. You could do a netstat and see who's listening on the ports. You can do PSs. You can do all kinds of things because you have active agents on the machines. Interesting, this is the one that people have the most trouble with when I talk to them about it, is discovering systems. The ARP protocol actually every system that ever does an ARP on your subnet will show up. This IPv6 is obviously a different deal, and I need to think some more about that. But from an IPv4 perspective, everybody who ever asks for an IP address shows up at least briefly in your ARP cache, even if they aren't asking for an address from you, because of the way the RFCs work. So if you have 100 active machines on the network, one of them is going to see this guy show up in their ARP cache briefly. So we say, hey, this new system showed up. And then we just say, oh, but look, we're not monitoring it. Now we can say, look, we have servers we are not monitoring. We should, you should go fix that. That's a problem. We can also discover switches and configuration information. CDP and LLDP, which is actually implemented in the code now, tell you what switch, which switch you're connected to and which port you're on. It tells you accurately, as opposed to the documentation you have, which tells you something which someone believed was accurate at one time. Services, I actually have written some of the code for detecting services, and it tells you, for example, what the binary is, what its current directory is, what all the arguments it was invoked with are, what port it's listening on, what IP address it's listening on, and so on and so on. Quite a bit of data. User ID, group ID, so on. And the interesting thing here is service dependencies. I'll go into more of how this works in a minute, but it also can discover service dependencies. That is to say, this machine is running this process on this machine, which is making is a client of this service on this other machine on this other port. And you can then create dependency graphs of client-server relationships in that fashion. And the neat thing about that, from the perspective of monitoring, is if you have a cascading failure where 15 machines are all showing red, you want to find the machine that is red that doesn't depend on any other machine that's red. And those are the places to start looking for your problems. That's the closest thing from a graph theoretic perspective to the root cause. Picks up network configuration, other stuff. We have sort of a general API for this. I'll show you in a minute. It comes up. But I have a basic API. We can discover whatever you want to discover. The meaning of it, that remains to be seen, but we can discover anything and stick it in the database, and what you do with it after that is not completely clear in all cases. So continuous discovery is because it's really initial configuration is labor intensive. If I can tell you, here are your services. Do you want to just, this is a web server. You want to monitor it with the web server monitoring thing? Click here, and we can go from there. I tell you what you have to monitor rather than you telling me what it is that I should be monitoring. It's a different perspective. If you're not monitoring everything, they're very slow to repair, and it happens. People don't get everything right. It does happen. Knowing the dependencies, root cause, initial configuration quickly becomes out of date. Configuration update processes are rarely bulletproof and often manual. Now, we don't like for them to be manual, but they often are. I mean, I think that I heard from one of the Puppet people that 15% of all data centers have something as nice as Puppet or Chef in place, which creates a great opportunity from that perspective. But another thing that's interesting from talking to people here is, wouldn't it be nice for me to discover all this information and then figure out how to create a Puppet or Chef or bconfig2 configuration out of what we know is actually running in your data center? Not what you want, but what is running. Could I reproduce it if I had to? Oh, no, by the way, what wouldn't I like to have that on my disaster recovery site? why does this kind of matter? It supports monitoring, as I said here, talked about this. One of the nice things here is it's not confused by non-standard ports. I know what process is on that port. I am not in any mystery about what's on port 25. It may not be the standard thing. I don't care. I'm not going to be confused by that. It doesn't trigger network security alarms. And in terms of system understanding and documentation, if you're like an ISP, if you're a company that's doing outsourcing, you often get a whole pile of machines that you're suddenly taking over that the customer may not have documented very well at all. And now you have that problem to deal with. This provides the documentation understanding. You can then have questions, answer questions about what is the architecture of our system really, and what would it look like if we made this change? What would be affected? You can answer these questions because you'll have that kind of data. And you could, you know, if you really want to do that, you could probably audit it against an ITIL CMDB or create one. I mean, these are all, understanding this is a work in progress and it's not done, these are the kinds of possibilities that exist, however. So I'm going to go on and talk about how I discover various things here. But before I do that, is this making sense to people? Does this seem reasonable? There are two pieces to it. One piece is order one and one piece is not.
Well, but if you consider the system as a whole, they're both order n.
Okay. But clearly. But the nice thing is the work on any given machine does not grow as a result of the growth of the network. And that's very important. And that's different from saying it's order n. That's a distinction that makes a difference. So the total work does, in fact, grow, yes. The work on any one server is order one.
Right.
And that distinction, it's different. The normal servers set up to grow order in, but it's order in on one machine. And that makes it complicated to maintain and manage and grow and so on. So is the distinction here that I use those terms. I understand why you might disagree with what I'm saying, but I'm trying to make a distinction that I think makes a difference. And maybe I'm not using quite the right words, but it's close to the right words. There is an argument for which I can make the argument that says the work on any one machine is order one. Total work is absolutely order n, has to be. You have more things to monitor. I mean, I don't see how you can monitor them without monitoring them, you know. But the work on any one machine, because it's so uniformly distributed, is in fact order one. So discovering switches. If you listen with CDP or to CDP or LLDP packets, they will tell you what switch you're connected to, and they'll tell you things like what port number, what VLAN ID, port MTU, speed, duplex, and switch capabilities there are. And you can then audit that against what your operating system is set to and discover that your OS has a bigger MTU than your switch does, for example. Or not. Ideally, you'd like to say that you don't do that. And this helps the Order 1 heartbeat protocol to discover that. If I know what rings you're on, you might as well talk in a ring on your switch. I mean, then you might that way most of your packets stay within the switch, and that's the cheapest bandwidth that you own. It costs basically nothing to send the small number of packets that stay within a switch. And so on and so on. You can imagine a little iPad app that says, okay, I'm here at the switch cabinet, I'm here at the switch, I'm supposed to work on machine Fred, and it draws a red circle around the port that Fred's actually plugged into as opposed to the one the documentation says. Now, I know that never happens at your site where the documentation doesn't match the real system, but I've seen it happen. So for discovering systems, I talked about the ARP cache. You look at your ARP cache, and you look at it periodically. And if you look at it, let's say you have a 256 machines on your subnet and you're looking at it on 100 of them, you are going to see pretty soon, once that machine starts talking on the network, you're going to see it. One of the machines will discover it and send, hey, we've seen it. Eventually, everybody will discover it. Now, this is definitely not order one, because in fact, every machine is going to discover that eventually. Every machine in that domain. Discovering services offered. Examine listening ports. Look at this kind of stuff. And /proc contains a wealth of information about it. You grab its process ID, go to /proc, you find out a lot of interesting things like what user IDs it's running as, what arguments it's evoked at. For example, it doesn't help to know that they're running Java. It doesn't help to know that they're running Python. It's not very helpful. What you want to know is, What Java application are they running? What Python application are you running? And all this is going to say is Java or Python in that column. So you'll want to go to /proc and get the other information. Now, discovering service dependencies, you can do a netstat minus utnp to find out the services you're a client of. And this is actually off of my machines at home. And so I see that I have a VNC viewer on this machine that's talking to 10.10.10.4 on port 5900. And if I go down there, follow that link down to 10.5900 on this machine, I see I've got a Vino server. I'm running VNC, right? Now I have a dependency graph that I've created out of putting the pieces together, what I see on one machine and what I see on another machine, and I can create a dependency graph of how all the pieces fit together without sending any packets on the network. So the security police are not going to come lock you up because you're port scanning. And because this is so cheap to do and it only reports things upstream when they change, you can do it all the time, more or less. I mean, not every second, but every few seconds or every few minutes on this kind of thing. If you look at it every 10 minutes, you're doing really good. You know, if you discover that a new service has been started within 10 minutes, you light up a light that says that's happened, that's really good, because otherwise it might take you months to discover it's happened. You know, it basically is free to do. And as long as it doesn't change, there's nothing to report upstream. No news is good news. And that creates, those three together create this service dependency graph. And this is a trivial one, but in the real life, you're going to see more complicated ones with, you know, databases and J2EE servers and this servers and that servers and proxies and various things all together in a big morass, right? But as long as they're running TCP and they have continuous connections, or at least they show up often enough that we capture them. You know, if you have somebody who, you know, an application that connects and disconnects, you're going to have to wait till you see activity for it to actually show up. But you're going to catch it. Maybe not right away, but within a day. And a day is pretty fast on the scale of changing things in your data center. A day would be really slow, I think, relative to what you actually expect. But still, I think that's pretty fast compared to the human scale of making changes. So this is the architecture of the nanoprobes. So some of you may have picked up, I call this a simulation monitoring project, and I call the little things you put on your machines nanoprobes. Well, if you don't like Star Trek, you'll be offended by this, but I had to choose some name, so I chose that name. And nanoprobe actually makes a lot of sense. It is intended to be small and lightweight. They're written in C, and it's 100 kilobytes or so of code. Might be a quarter megabyte by the time I get done. But you know, basically, you get incoming commands, and either they deal with monitoring or they deal with discovery. And if for server monitoring, it's just really basically, it gets commands that says, like, send a heartbeat to this machine, expect a heartbeat from this machine, and intervals for both, right? And for the service monitoring, you'll have commands that basically get proxied through to the LRM. This hasn't been written yet, but the LRM has. The proxy hasn't been written. The LRM, of course, has been. And for discovery, the output of the discovery basically is one of two forms, either the LLDP or CDP. I made the choice not to decode the packets beyond the minimal amount on the nanoprobes to just minimize the amount of knowledge they have to have. And if you otherwise, every time you get a new version of something, you have to update this. And so basically, it only knows a very small amount about LLDP and CDP and sends the packets up intact. And lets all the logic of understanding all the different versions of firmware and all the different packet layouts that you can get with LLDP to the central system. But for everything else, they output JSON. You know, you basically, for example, these are like 100-line shell scripts that just output JSON. They're really not complicated. And you know, we can discover anything you want and put it in the database. The question is, what does it mean, and what do you do with the data when you get it there? That involves writing more code and so on to go with it. But from the perspective of the nanoprobes, they don't care. If they have the script, they'll run it and spit the JSON back. And what it means, as I said, is up to the central system to figure out. And of course, as usual, infrastructure, marshalling, demarshalling. This is actually where most of my code is right now, is actually in all this low-level stuff. And I have a prototype of the central monitoring authority. which is written in Python, and it basically talks to the Neo4j database. Because most of this data, if you think about it, what you really want to know to understand the effects of things, particularly from a monitoring perspective, is a dependency graph. So I said, why wouldn't I just put it in a graph database? Because, for example, with Neo4j, I can give it with a single query, one hit to the database, tell me all the machines which are lit red and don't depend on anyone that's lit red. That is a query you can do in one fell swoop, no matter how many levels of dependencies you go through to a graph database. And it comes back in milliseconds. If you do it through a relational database, you have to join and join and join and join, and it winds up taking minutes, actually, to do the same work. And so the other thing that's interesting about a graph database from this perspective is it only depends on the size of the subgraph I'm currently concerned with, not on the total number of nodes in the system. So if I have a collection of 20 servers that provide a service, it doesn't matter that it's in a collection of 10 million machines. It's really only concerned with those 20 machines. And so the order of, for example, a join gets slower and slower and slower and slower depending on the total number of machines, not on the size of the subgraph you're looking at. Obviously, there's some seek time issues and stuff, but they're not really the dominating issue. This is currently in process. And so here's what the status is right now. The nanoprobe code is in pretty good shape. It's not done. It's in pretty good shape. It's there. It's operational. I've written 5 discovery agents, one for CDP and LLDP, network configuration, listening ports, OS, and CPU discovery. And I've written some of this initial creates a single ring, in-memory data only, except I'm currently writing this stuff to put it in Neo4j. That's what I said I did a 300,000 node test. I did that strictly in memory. But hey, it was promising. Looks reasonable. This 250,000, 300,000, depends on when I wrote this. Currently writing the code to construct the system graph. That's the status of things. Am I over time? What's my time here? Okay. So future plans and possibilities. The Neo4j stuff I'm doing right now isn't releasing transactions properly. There's really only one piece of this that's, most of it's idempotent. In other words, if I don't act the packet, he'll just keep beating on me to update the database, and updating the database, even if I didn't have a transaction, is going to correct it, except for the making the linked list. That piece has to be in transactions. I'm looking for a production release by the end of this year. Not necessarily the most wonderful production release, no GUI, but functional. Clustering for HA and capacity, future architecture, I have a slide on that. Integration with the LRM has to happen, resource control, as well as monitoring. It's certainly happy to start and stop things, but people might not be happy to let me do that on their behalf. But community building, obviously, multi-ring architecture, appliance monitoring. This is perfectly able to monitor appliances as well, but you would just then, appliance being something I can't put a nanoprobe in. Anything that I can't put a nanoprobe in, therefore, is an appliance. It's able to monitor those. If you have 1,000 machines, I have 1,000 machines to spread that monitoring among. So any of the machines would be happy to do it. You may have to get people irritated if I do it with certain machines, but. Configuration GUI, mobile support, visualization. Visualization tools, I think there's a big deal here, a possibility for helping you understand what's really going on in your system here if we have the right visualization tools. And there's a right mental model here in terms of how to configure this and make it match something closer to the mental model of the people who are doing this. It's pretty clear that I can tell you a lot about your system. And in fact, honestly, for everything, I could start monitoring a lot of stuff. It's just a question of, do you really want me to start monitoring it on my own, or do you want to click a button that says, yes, go ahead? Obviously, importance classification of systems and services. You know, the fact that it's broken, maybe nobody cares. There is a certain percentage of stuff that nobody cares, at least not until Monday. Right? Multi-tenant support, big, interesting, challenging thing here. In terms of role-based access control and all that stuff in a multi-tenant environment. Multi-level physical and virtual support, understanding that maybe I'm monitoring the physical layer as a ring and I'm monitoring the virtual machines as services, but I'm also monitoring on the virtual machines as services as well. you know, that it's clearly the architecture is capable of that. Am I prepared to do it? Not really, not anytime soon. These are possibilities. These are the kinds of things that enter my head as I think about what one can do with a system like this. Lots more discovery modules. If I discover that you're running a certain application, maybe I want to start running a discovery module to tell you how it's configured, or some other aspect of it that would be helpful and useful in auditing against best practices. Because a lot of imagine getting all this data in one place and then having an engine that would say, how am I comparing how I'm managing these systems to best practices? Limited non-stealth discovery. Certain things, you know, if I want to discover your storage beyond the level of what Linux will tell me or your OS will tell you, you know, if I want to like probe the storage, I'm going to have to talk to it. Some things I'm going to have to talk to, like appliances. I can tell you an IP address is out there, but if it's not something I can put a nanoprobe on, the only way I'm going to figure out anything more is to do something non-stealthy. But I really want to get this going with the stealthy part, because you can put that in your system and not have to get permission from God and country to do it. Statistical data collection, a big deal. Now, since I know what's on your system, I probably have a pretty good idea of what kind of data you might want to collect, including some that are specific to the applications you're running. I know that, you know, if I know what's on your system, I can suggest to you what we know are good things to monitor on that system statistically. Now, that's clearly order in, by the way. Data center analytics of all kinds. Generate IT integration with other systems, trouble testing, change management, configuration management, right? Maybe, like I said, generates information that would help you create a puppet or a chef or whatever your configuration is on the basis of what you actually have out there as a way of getting bootstrapped and coming into an environment. Or auditing it against what you think is actually there and from a different perspective, right? And this is what I'm currently thinking about future CMA architecture. Is GearMan is just a choice of packet dispatcher, which can dispatch work over either single machines or multiple machines, and you know you'd have a process for which would repair a certain number of rings, and just a way of scaling up if you really need to scale up. I don't know if I do or not, but it's a thought. But query engines and so on, I could easily imagine. My guess is that most of the time on this system will not be spent doing monitoring, nor spent gathering new data, but doing analytics on what you have here. If I'm successful. If you fail, of course, none of this matters. This is what, for example, the network discovery stuff comes out looking like. And it has some stuff from the IP command, some stuff from /sys, like the names of the devices and whether they have carrier and what their duplex and MTU and operational state and speed is. Default gateway is just handy to know. It's really a routing piece of information, but it turns out to be really nice to know which interface is probably the best interface to talk to it on in general. You know, what is it? Which interface is its default gateway? Here are the IP addresses, scope. This kind of stuff, just JSON. I mean, it's just JSON. But the idea is it's not hard to create this. It's not rocket science. You know, it's a few hundred lines of code, shell scripts. And my experience in Linux HA is if you want sysadmins to do it for you, make it where they can do it as a shell script. Sometimes they'll write Python, sometimes they'll write some other language, but 90% of what sysadmins will provide for you is shell scripts. This is the corresponding stuff for listening ports. So this stuff here come down this stuff up here down through port and process ID, I guess, comes from netstat, but the stuff from here below, the executable, the command line options, user ID, group ID, and current working directory, those all come from /proc. But I bring them together in one place in a useful way and provide it in JSON, and it doesn't care, how I got that data. So I've kind of beat this to death. Questions? Yes, sir. My phone? Okay, well, I moved it. So, yeah, go ahead.
So it seems like your network transactions will really be dominated by the information being reported by the end nodes, which is going to scale with your design linearly, right?
Exactly.
And have you considered any alternate approaches for that?
So what you said is true, and let me say something else to modify it, and then we'll come back to the second half of what you said. So it's going to scale, but it only gets reported when something changes.
Well, but how do you deal with, you said something about idempotence and there have to be periodic heartbeats too, right?
So a discovery information, so there are axon packets. So let's say I'm a nanoprobe and I'm going to give you an update and you crash in the middle of my giving you the update,
okay,
right? Then you're not going to act that packet until you've completed the transaction. So I'm going to keep trying to send it to you, and you'll fail over to the other machine or whatever you do to restart. And eventually, you're going to come up and start running again, and that packet will eventually get stuck in there, get put in. The discovery data will get stuck in. That's what I was talking about, idempotence.
Okay, so it's
the discovery data is idempotent.
It's a stateful process where each nanoprobe effectively creates a series of uniquely identified states, and then it pushes them upstream.
Yeah.
And that process is reliable.
It's intended to be.
Well, it's hopefully, it's optimistically reliable, right?
That's the design. The design is that it be reliable. How's that?
So we did a bunch of work, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, looking at doing scalable anomaly detection. So
scalable what? I'm sorry.
Anomaly detection.
Yes.
Right? So looking for outliers and things like that.
Yes.
And so one of the things, and this isn't a particularly new approach entirely. Ron Minnick's guys did this with Supermon back, 10 years ago, maybe a little more. But basically, what they built is a monitoring stream protocol that was aggregatable. And so as you, they used a reduction tree, right? And there was a topology that the information would flow through, and every time you got something from one of your downstream peers, you would reduce it with the data that you got from other downstream peers,
yes,
or your local data, and you passed up a much smaller quantity of data upstream. And this,
yes,
gave you the ability to do metrics, right? Because metrics are going to change all the time.
I understand that. Notice I said, when I started out, I said this is that's not the goal of this project. Obviously, it has to happen in the future. But for the short term, I want to get this up and running in the scope of
just discovery information.
Well, two things: discovery on the one hand, and failure detection or exception detection. And when I get that up and going, I'm successful at that. Then people will start beating on me for statistics, and then that will make a lot of sense. But right now, that's not my near-term goal is to get the damn thing. Pardon me, I shouldn't say that. Get it working.
Fair enough.
Thanks, though. So one thing I will say here in general, without active agents on every machine, you get no scalability. I have people push back on active agents, and the truth is you could have a cluster of 20 of these machines operating like this and treating the rest of the world as appliances. That will work. It kind of defeats the purpose, but it would work. And it would be simpler to manage than a lot of things, but it would kind of be stinky compared to the grand and glorious vision, as it were. So, please, Mr. Clark.
The notion of nanoprobe and not analyzing your packets too much, and I'm wondering, okay, there's an Apache server, there is a web server running there.
Yes.
Do you envision being able to say, and it's Apache, and it's serving,
yes,
the following,
yes,
websites?
So I can't, let's take the example of, I have the discovery that would detect that. It will tell you what port it's listening on, what process it is, you know, which would presumably tell you something like a process name, which would be ended in something which was like Apache 2 or something like that, right? And I could also imagine then once you discover that you're running Apache, running a discovery module which figures out which version of Apache you're running. You know, runs it with the minus V option or whatever method of determining the version is for that particular kind of thing that you have on the machine. But it would tell you not just that, but by the fact that that process ID is listing on several different ports. Now, as far as which websites, there's an additional piece of information with respect to Apache that it goes, first is the IP addresses you listen to. Many IP addresses, many websites have the same IP address.
Right.
So then you have to go to the Apache configuration. And if you have an Apache discovery module, which picks that information out on the basis of understanding the Apache configuration data, which is part of why I mentioned about running a discovery module that's based on knowing what you're running. I know you're running Apache 2, therefore I'll run an Apache 2 discovery module, which goes and looks at pokes around and figures this stuff out.
How are you going to find it?
How I'm going to find which?
I've just started an Apache server.
So I'll notice that it's on the. I'll see it's on a listing on a port.
Right.
And I'll know what binary it is. I'll send that back to the central server, which will say, "Oh, you have this new thing. Would you like to? It looks like it's Apache. Would you like to run the Apache discovery module on it?" You click yes on that button. I mean, that's the theory. This is all in my head. You understand?
Yeah.
But so I want to make that clear. This is vaporware out of my head. But you click the button that says, I want to run the Apache discovery module. It then goes there. It knows how to figure out what's interesting about Apache on the basis of the arguments that was given, like the minus F some file name for the configuration file, which then parses the configuration file or knows how to, brings that data back. That's how one would do such a thing in this architecture, and it will work. Is anybody going to write all these different things? Well, that remains to be seen, doesn't it? But does this make sense to you?
The concept makes sense, but what I'm concerned about is, all right, I've got a user who has fired off a rogue web server.
Yes.
And it's not obvious because it's using assorted defaults, and we don't...
But the fact that it wasn't there before and it is there now is something that I will have observed and note. If you wished, you could imagine this even cutting trouble tickets, saying that you have to resolve this trouble ticket by saying that it's okay because that was resolved by this other trouble ticket which allowed us to do it. There are a lot of possibilities here. What the right answer is, that this when I mentioned community involvement, man, I am not nearly smart enough to figure all this stuff out.
So what I hear you saying for the specific question I'm asking, is not a negative statement, is that you may not be able to say it's running the following websites, but at least I'll know that there is something out there, and that will allow the human to go ahead and investigate.
And if you had an Apache discovery module, right?
But that may not work, given the methodology that you proposed, but we don't need to argue that here. But even if you can't find out all the information automatically.
I can tell you exactly what it is and what port it's listing on. For example, you can imagine somebody listening on port 65431, which is a well-known Trojan horse port. And maybe you want to say, oops, we didn't really want that Trojan horse to be running on this machine. Now, of course, there are security ways to hide that and blah, 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 blah. It's not, the purpose is not security, but it will tell you a lot of things that you didn't intend to have going on in your site. Yeah.
Half joking, but half not, right?
Well, of course. But one of the parts of the discovery could be to do a checksum on it. And the checksum, there ought to be a limited number of Apache versions in your environment, and it ought to match one of your checksums, right? And that would be not at all difficult to do. Would it be desirable to do? I can't say. You saw my long list of 2 pages of really cool stuff to do. And the question is, how do you prioritize this, and how do I create a community big enough to really come make this reality? If I'm pedaling this bicycle, we're not getting there. Sorry.
That's cool. I'm probably in danger of beating your point with a dead horse.
That's one of my many skills. Come join me.
Okay. So one thing that keeps me up at night when it comes to monitoring is... the reliability itself of the monitoring system.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that troubles me about no news is good news policy.
Yes.
I agree with you, it's the key to scalability, but at the same time, if something isn't checking in with me, if something's checking in with me and it's never getting through to me, how do I know that it's not getting through to me?
For example, if there's a route between, first of all, it's going to keep it's gonna keep trying. It's gonna keep sinning and acting. How are you gonna know that that's sitting there, it's constipated and sitting there trying really hard to send you stuff and not succeeding? For example, if you have some firewall rule, firewall rules are the bane of the existence of everything in the universe, really. Because that's the most, the most common problem when people first install Linux HA or the pacemaker stuff is that it isn't working for them because their firewall is blocking all our heartbeats. So the assumption is that if I'm using the same, port as all the rest of the heart beating, if there's something that, that permits me to talk to my peers and for them to talk to me and doesn't allow me to also talk to the central system, first of all, it has to have, when it first comes up, it's not going to come up and join the system at all unless it can talk to me once. Because it wakes up and says, hello, oh, what do I do now? And it tries to connect to the central system. If it can't do that, then that machine will never be shown as being up. So you would have to come in afterwards and change the routes or the rule, the firewall rules to break that. You could do that. It can happen. I mean, one way to deal with it, if that's a concern to you, is you could have a round robin porter that every minute or every 30 seconds that there is definitely a plan in here to have a ping type thing which says, I send a message to you and you come back and you say I'm okay. But it's not the norm of the monitoring. You could use that mechanism. You know, you could have a sort of roving pointer that every 10 seconds talks to one machine and says, are you still there? You can certainly do that. I wasn't planning on doing it, but the question is, what are we going to discover the actual problems we have to deal with are? And is that one of the ones that comes up in practice? And that's why I talk about not being smart enough to know how to do this myself. Because the only thing that's smart enough is the experience of the people who are using it. They're the ones who are going to inform me on what we're doing wrong. And that might be one of them. But there are solutions to most problems. And that, for example, that's a...
I mean, that's just one of those things that I've considered. And it reduces your overall scalability, but it might... It's something that I've thought...
So...
Maybe it's...
It is still talking to its peers. It is still talking to its peers.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, and if it fails to talk to its peers, they will report it. And if the switch fails, we will also report that. Now there is no monitoring system which has no holes. It's not going to happen, ever. The question is this a hole that's going to matter to you? And I don't know the answer to that question. Does that make sense? And if it, you have to get this out there and get people trying it. How many people here think you could design this without the feedback of people telling you what you did wrong? I see smiles around the room. I think that's the answer to that question. I don't know. The holes in here, I'm sure I don't yet see. I'm sure, there's experience is going to teach us things that we would have no idea of. Yes?
I think the number one thing that you have to do to make this successful is to separate the network system, which aggregates and reports data, from the system that does local discovery of information, because they're both very useful, but they really have different purposes and different architectures. So the local discovery...
I have to have the... What started me on this is I already had to have discovery to start. I had to have the switch discovery in order to build the local rings. And I don't think... I see these two as very complementary. I don't want two systems. I don't want... If you get their advantages that come, for example, the no news is good news philosophy, the knowledge that you're not going to know, that something new is not going to happen without you knowing it, and the fact that if I don't have that discovery information, I'm going to ask you how to configure it. But if I have the discovery information, I can tell you how to configure it. Huge difference in usability. Huge difference. So I think there's huge. I think there's a big advantage to having the two together. Now, the question is, when I create a database, what interesting things can we get out of that database? What if this works? Oh my God, what interesting stuff could we have in there that you would love to know? And what discovery modules would you want to write to discover the things that you need to know for your customers? Or what analytics could you perform on it that would create? That would create the configuration for your deployment systems, but I don't I think there are big advantages to combining them. I think that's something, because I can tell you what to monitor. Otherwise, you have to tell me. And that's night and day difference in terms of how quick it is to. Part of what I want to do here, I have to have a. If I want to, 70%, at least 70% of the people who want to use this already have a system. And they may hate it, but they the more they hate it, the more reluctant they are to change it because it's so painful to get it that way. I have to have something to come in and convince people, oh my God, this is amazing. And I'm doing things that they couldn't do for themselves. It's easy to get started, has to have a great out-of-the-box experience. And I think the discovery is a part of that great out-of-the-box experience. If I don't have that great out-of-the-box experience, nobody's adopting this.
So how do you want to deal with the fact that a rogue agent can compromise all the data for a ring or several rings?
First of all, there are in the architecture there are he can't compromise the data for more than himself. At least that's the thinking.
Well, if the data is passed around the ring,
it's not passed. He's only talking to his neighbors, and only heartbeats. Only heartbeats go to his neighbors.
So then it's end to one for everything else.
Right.
Because that's not going
to
work.
But everything else is only first of all, for monitoring, everything else is passing it to, so passing it to your neighbors. For discovery, there's no way to if you
about discovery, I'm saying that when you
reported
something
data.
New out, so you reboot a container worth of machines with a new kernel. So they all say, hey, I've got a new state. Here you go.
Yes.
N of them will do that and basically hit your central authority with a hammer.
And most of them will have the same configuration as they had before. Most of them will have the same.
Not a very safe assumption.
It's statistically speaking, it's likely to be the case. It may not be the case.
You have a boot storm waiting to happen.
I'm sorry, you have a what?
A boot storm waiting to happen.
So one of the if you remember, I didn't intend to gloss over it, but one of the things is a potential slowness at boot time. But what is the result of slowness at boot time? The result of slowness at boot time is that it takes a little longer to start monitoring everything.
But you also have like an unintended difference in the reported data. So you report PIDs.
I'm probably going to get rid of the PIDs for exactly that reason. They're in there because I need to. It's going to complicate writing the script, but because I want to know when one process is serving more than one port or IP address, and they're reported separately by netstat, but I really want them reported aggregated, so I need to turn the data upside down and probably rewrite that agent. But I don't. PIDs are an example of a piece of data which needs to be filtered out. It's in. I originally didn't have it in there at all, but I added it because it's useful to be able to tell some processes listen on all addresses, some listen on every address individually. So it kind of depends on. That one's not done right, honestly. That agent's not done the way I want it to be done. But I haven't really. I've been thinking over how I want the data done right. I haven't come to a conclusion yet, but I don't like having PIDs in there. Yes.
Sort of a twofold question.
Please.
What is your current polling interval? I say that in air quotes for the.
It is intended that you. For there are different things to be polled here, right?
Okay.
There's heartbeat intervals. How often you send heartbeats. And there are how often for any given service you run a monitor operation. And the monitor operation might be complex or it might be simple. For example, maybe you do a query in a database and you look at the result and see if it looks reasonable. And that's a relatively expensive one. You might do a file system check you might make a snapshot and file system check it, right? That's a very expensive monitor operation. You know, there are a variety, and the answer is there is no one answer to that question.
Right.
But there are at least three kinds. Discovery interval, how often you, and the discovery interval depends a lot on the discovery item. For example, I want to look at ARP cache every few seconds or every few minutes, but I don't need to look at The process is running, but every few minutes, and I don't need to look at the CPU configuration maybe once. So it depends on every there are a bunch of individual cases here. So I don't have a particular fixed interval in mind for any of those.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, perfect sense. In fact, I didn't think through the question before I asked
it. It's not a problem. Someone else had the same question.
Oh.
No, there's no doubt that someone else had the same question.
Oh, okay. And the second part was, how do you determine the optimum, which you sort of answered. It's sort of on a case-by-case basis, manual process.
And more to the point, it will probably be wrong at first.
Okay.
I mean, my expectation is that that's the kind of thing that you have to learn through people's experience. With the HA stuff, all the things that turned out to cause people problems were not things I guessed. I didn't guess that firewalls were going to be the bane of people first setting it up. I didn't guess that 90% of all false failure reports for failures were timeout intervals. I mean, I didn't know those things. I found them out because people kept complaining about them. It's like, oh, huh. So now I know. If somebody says, it complained my service was dead when it was really alive, well, it's probably a timeout interval. 9 out of 10 times it is.
About your open to-do list, wouldn't it be, I don't know, nice? I have, in my organization, I have two monitors running in parallel. I have Sabix and Nagios.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be nicer if, well, several of your to-do list is already deployed in, well, Sabix, basically. Wouldn't it be nicer to do your basic core system to as a Sabix module to start up this discovering? Because I already have used months or years tuning Nagios, and now we're starting with Sabix, and we do have what it takes to have, well, enough noise. Minimizing the noise, but getting the right alarms. So I think it would be nicer to have something that it could integrate into the tools we already have.
Well, the problem with the tools you already have don't do the things this does.
Exactly.
And they don't scale the same way. And integrating with them would tie me to my weaknesses and their weaknesses too.
Yeah, but if you can, like...
So for example, I could easily add, I mentioned that this thing takes mm-hmm. multiple kinds of APIs. I could easily add Nagios APIs till I use Nagios agents. Mm-hmm. But according to people I've used, say that use Nagios, their biggest problem with it is the agents are broken. And so I don't think that's my first choice. It might be something that turns out to be valuable. But I just want to get, right now, my short-term goal is to just get it up and get it working. And if someone wants to, you know, it's an open source project, someone wants to write something to convert your existing configuration into this configuration, that's fine. But I wouldn't object to that. Am I going to do it? Not very likely. I just don't, you know, I have a long list of things to do.